You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, February 7th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody. Yay! Where'd all these people come from?
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Yay! And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, everyone.
So we are currently recording episode 501, the first of maybe what will be our next 500 episodes. But today, so you know, this is a typical Saturday for me. I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I did 6 hours of post-production on the show.
Is that all?
And show 500.
And show 500. So show 500 went live today at noon, and that's why we're all gathered here today to celebrate our 500th episode going live. Yay! So you may have noticed that there are a lot of guests with us here today. Thank you all for coming out to help us celebrate our 500th episode. Jay's going to walk around with a microphone, and we're going to talk to a few of the people here.
The first guest of our next decade, our friend Massimo. Massimo was the very first interview we did. He wasn't on episode one.
No, but he was the first interview. That's right.
But he was our first interview.
What the heck did we talk about anyway?
Sex life. It was a really short discussion.
Excellent. Good.
It's like
always interesting.
Minutes, yeah.
That's always interesting.
We got in and we got
talked
out,
about like evolutionary psychology.
Naturally.
No, right. I was trying to convince you that evolutionary psychology had some value, and you were trying to convince me that it didn't.
I think there's value in there, as long as we agree on what they're saying.
You've moderated a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
10 years.
Yeah, you get older, you know, wiser, and all that sort of stuff.
So when we interviewed you, did you remember? Like, did you even know who we were, or was that the first time you had heard of us?
I heard of Steve for some reason. Yes, but through
you had given talks for us for the New England Skeptical Society, though.
That's right. That's right. I'd already given.
And that's why
talk
I already had you so, on right, my email right. Because right. You had already given a live.
See, it's a good thing that he actually took notes.
Right.
Because I have no idea what the hell. And it wasn't a period of my life during which I was doing drugs either. So it's like, but in fact, there's never been such a period in my life. I need to catch up.
So philosophically.
Speaking.
Meaning, yeah, I want you to give me the philosophical perspective of how has skepticism changed in the last 10 years?
In all sorts of different directions, some of which are good and some of which I don't think that's necessarily that good. I mean, you guys have been one of the best directions, I think, of skepticism over the last decade or so. And clearly the movement, if we want to talk about a movement, has become more popular, lots more people involved, lots more conferences. So all of that is very good development. Interestingly, since you mentioned philosophy, I think that actually the one thing that the early skeptics, and I'm talking about people like Carl Sagan, or if you want to go further back all the way to David Hume, we can do that as well. But it was about science and philosophy. The two, you can't do one without the other. You know, if you're talking about critical thinking, if you're talking about epistemology, if you're talking, you know, theory of knowledge and all that, you're doing philosophy and you're doing metaphysics actually in some cases when you're talking about certain discussions within skepticism. So I always thought that philosophy and science had to go hand in hand, as far as the skeptic movement is concerned. What I noticed, on the other hand, was in the last several years, a significant rejection, and sometimes even outright hostility, actually, toward philosophy. So, and I think there's reasons for it. The most important source of sort of blame for this new attitude is the so-called science wars of the 90s, when a small but very, very vocal subgroup of philosophers known as postmodernists started spouting all this nonsense about, oh, science is just another cultural activity and it's, evolution is just as good as creationism because after all, you know, who knows, on what you can ground your knowledge. That was very damaging in general to the relationship between science and philosophy. The overreaction, however, has been just that, an overreaction on the part of even a number of prominent scientists who are very active in the skeptic movement. I will not name names. Oh, yes, I will. Lawrence Krauss, you know, my friend Neil deGrasse Tyson, and all those people who I've taken to task on that particular topic. They started thinking of philosophy as postmodernism, which is weird because, in fact, the best criticism and best rejection of sort of epistemic relativism and postmodernism in general did come from philosophers, especially philosophers of science. Philosophers of science have always been a staunch supporters of science as a privileged activity in terms of knowing how the world works. So it's an unfortunate thing. It's not necessarily anything new, because the divide between the two cultures has been around at least since the beginning of the century, meaning the last century. But I think that in terms of the skeptic movement, that's not a good development. And so I'm trying to do my little part to sort of redress that thing. And we'll see the next 10 years.
I'm going to pass the microphone to one of our oldest friends. This is Larry Fitzgerald. Larry went to school with Bob and Steve. And Larry has a couple of funny stories about Steve when he was young. And
can we actually...
Say whatever
the
you
FCC,
want.
The FCC, the rules about this?
No, you can say it. Go ahead.
Really, actually, I was... You were talking about the history of where this all came from. Your memory really, really sucks, so you won't remember this. But Steve and Evan will remember, and Bob. I guess Bob got a call from somebody, and this goes back before you guys were even really too involved with the NES. There was a Halloween radio program, and they were looking for someone skeptical to debate these ghost hunter people in a house that supposedly was haunted. Bob got a call from somebody. Bob, I don't remember who called you, but then you said, well, you know, I can get some people together. And so, you know, for longtime fans of the show, Perry, myself, Steve, Evan, Bob.
Was that for the radio show?
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah, I know you. I'm just saying you won't remember it because your memory sucks.
I remember a little bit.
So fallible.
And Jay.
Did I have a good time?
You did. You had a great time, and you still owe me $50.
Okay.
So we went to this house. We went to this house, and there were these supposed ghost hunter people there. Steve, it was great. Steve sat down with this nice lady whose house it was. She was very sweet, and did the whole list of questions, almost some of them right out of Ghostbusters. You know, like, you know, is there a history of mental illness in your family? Yeah, there was a little bit of a history of mental illness in her family. The best part was, she's like, the people are, they're talking about all the stuff that happens in this house. Well, as, anybody who's not crazy realizes, nothing was happening in this house. It wasn't even settling noises. There was really nothing happening in this house. It was so boring as far as like no ghost activity whatsoever. The ghost people started making stuff up. One of us would be standing next to them. And they'd say, did you hear that? And, you know, obviously you'd say, no.
And now they have a famous cable TV show.
Yeah.
did you hear that?
They have their own cable. It's not those guys, right?
Might as well be, right?
Yeah,
it's like the same shit.
Yeah, just change the face, make a small asterisk next to the name. It's the same people.
That was our first investigation.
Yeah, your first investigation. Yeah. And from that, you know, stuff like Bob touching all the cool stuff that was hidden in the Warren's house when they weren't looking. It's like, whatever you do, don't touch this. They turn around, Bob starts licking it, you know. Stuff like that.
All right, thank you.
Anyway, that's all I got. Here you go.
We're going to start with our relatively new segment, Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
This week I'm going to talk about, for Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm going to talk about Augusta Ada King, Countess of Lovelace, more popularly known as Ada Lovelace. I'm sure a lot of people may be familiar with that name, but you may not be familiar with what she achieved, really. She was an English mathematician, and she was probably the first computer scientist ever. And she's got a very fascinating story. Have you guys ever heard of her?
Yes. No.
Some have. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
With this audience, I'm sure there are some, but she's not widely known. She was born in 1791 in London. She was the daughter of poet Lord Byron, who was also very famously known for his promiscuity, and his wife Anne was very afraid for her daughter, and she did not want her to become as, you know, as crazy and outlandish or as artistic as her father was, and he left the family when she was 2 years old, and she was gone. So the mom made sure that she had the best tutors, and she was tutored in math and mathematics and science. Like, not many women were done at that time at all, but she was tutored very strictly and heavily on that. Another thing that her mother did that I found very odd was that she tried to, like, kind of, she was afraid of her becoming like her dad, so she tried to, like, quash her imagination. So she would actually make her sit still for extended periods of time and not to move at all, to teach her self-control, and things like that when she was a kid, which was kind of strange, but that's how afraid she was of her becoming this person like her dad. She was very afraid of that. When Ada was 17, she met Charles Babbage. This was kind of a milestone in her life. Charles Babbage, I'm sure a lot of you guys know, he came up with the design for the difference engine and the analytical engine. The difference engine was the first automatic mechanical calculator. He never quite finished it, but he did have some pretty elaborate designs, and for various reasons, it was never finalized. But more importantly, he also designed The analytical engine, which is more of a mechanical general purpose computer, and that was never quite finished either, but still, it, these designs, were breakthroughs that weren't noticed for quite some time. So Ada was captivated, by his devices. She was just enthralled by them and wanted to learn as much as she could about these mechanical computers that he had designed. So, an Italian engineer wrote an article about the analytical engine, and that she was asked by Charles to translate it into English. So she took this article and translated it into English, and her translation was good, but she also wrote little notes here and there about what she was thinking and insights that she had. Her notes were three times longer than that article. She really was thinking long and hard and deeply about this, and she really came up with some amazing things. She realized that this device, this analytical engine, if it ever was created, would go far beyond mathematics. It would be able to do things that
like video
that
games?
Had never been, yeah, like video games.
City of Heroes?
She wasn't quite that prescient. But she realized that the codes in this computer can be used for letters and symbols and not just numbers, which nobody was really thinking of at that time. She actually wrote some code to create Bernoulli numbers that would, instructions that would loop and to repeat the same instructions. I mean, that's a common computer programming technique. And so for this and other reasons, she's considered to be the very first computer programmer. This is in, you know, the 1840s, 1850s.
Wow.
Quite an amazing achievement. But that's not even the coolest thing. She really was forward thinking. She said about this engine, she said that it might act upon other things besides numbers. The engine might compose elaborate and scientific pieces of music of any degree of complexity or extent. I mean, she really was taking this beyond mere mathematical calculation, but computation and computer science. She was sensing the glimmers of computer science that wouldn't be around for many, many decades. And nobody really at that time had any clue about what was coming. And she was the first one, even beyond Babbage, who was more of a mathematician engineer. She was the one that was really forward thinking and prescient, actually.
It sounds like she was also starting to think about the practical applications of what this would yield.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was clear in her mind, and it slowly became clear. And when they discovered her work a century later, they're like, wow, look at this. This is 100 years old.
So was the technology just was like at a plateau for a century before
No, they actually proved that they could create a difference engine with the technology at that time. But in terms of getting the funds and the expertise together for long enough to really pull it off, it just didn't happen. But if it did happen, I mean, our civilization could be quite different.
It'd be all steampunk,
imagine,
right?
Imagine, oh, that would be awesome. imagine real computers in the, you know, 100 years before they were, they were developed. That would be amazing. So.
Bob, was it a shortfall of engineering? Did they just not have the expertise, like, available to them immediately? Because you're saying the science was there. It could be done, but they didn't do it.
Right, they didn't do it, and it was a complicated scenario. They gave him money to make the difference engine, then they gave him 10 times that amount ultimately, and he didn't quite finish, but then he was doing the analytical engine, and they're like, well, why are you even moving on to another project? We wanted you to do this, and it just never kind of happened. So guys, remember Ada Lovelace, mention her to your friends, maybe if you want, maybe when discussing computationally deriving Bernoulli numbers from hyperbolic tangent functions, perhaps you might want to consider that, but remember what she accomplished. Thank you.
And if your friends turn to you and say, is that that porn star? You have to say, no, no, no. That's a different Lovelace.
Linda.
Linda. Yes.
Come on. So totally since you spoke up, John, this is John Blumenfeld is speaking. Say hi, John.
Hello.
Yes. John's been on the show a couple of times, but your history with us actually goes back way before the SGA.
Yeah, I was in the brick and mortar days.
You were
brick and
mortar, yeah.
Analog days.
So, and I was
1.0.
I was the first, I guess, and only president of the Connecticut Skeptical Society. I know Evan's probably never forgiven me for that because, like, I was the outsider. You guys were, you know, I mean, Jay wasn't really that involved at the time, but it was the three brothers and Evan and Perry who'd known you guys forever. And I was just a guy who had shown up to a couple of talks and said, wow, I really want to get involved with this. And you guys were looking for somebody to
basically work
to find speakers, you know,
exactly.
like Massimo Pagliucci and other people. So, that was how I got involved. And I had a great time.
How long were you with these guys?
It's a few years.
Yeah, well,
And then I had a second stint because one of the reasons why I left was because I worked for a firm that didn't want me out there publicly saying anything. Yeah. They were really paranoid. They're not in business anymore.
Oh,
anyway.
CIA, yeah, I know.
Didn't they destroy the economy?
They did. Yeah, understand. And so then when that happened, yeah. And it was right after, you know, as Perry passed away, and I was, you know, feeling it a lot. Yeah. And I came back to you guys and said, you know, I want to get involved again. And I started blogging on yeah. your blog. I started my own blog, which was a kind of economic skeptical thing, which I also had to shut down. Because then when I did get another job, they had the same attitude, which was, you know, we don't want you holding yourself out. And I unfortunately had to pull the plug.
Hey, are you unemployed again? Or are you
unfortunately, no, I'm still employed. But I have a feeling that the current place would either not notice or not care. So
yeah,
you never
know. You could fly under the radar.
No, but I always like to think of myself as like the Pete Best or yeah. Stu Sutcliffe of this group.
Yes.
Before you became really big was when I
never would have said that out loud, but thanks for saying that. Let's move on to some news items. How many people here have seen the video of Lars Anderson, who's changing the face of archery for everyone? I see this?
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yep.
So this has been a viral video in the last couple of weeks. Yeah. It's a guy who says that we're doing archery all wrong. And the audio commentary on the video, while he's jumping around shooting arrows, is going over like the history of archery and how come like modern archers are doing it all wrong, and you should hold the arrow on the right side of the bow instead of the left side of the bow. You should like be holding the arrows in your hand, and you could do this and be accurate. So a lot of people who are actual archers have taken exception to his version of the history of archery. You guys seen any of
Yes,
it's great.
You could put on some background music and it would go quite well. It's almost like a dance routine.
I first heard about it. People were talking exactly the reason why we bring it up. I'm at work and two people were talking about it, saying how that guy is exactly like Legolas.
Yeah.
Like he's the real world Legolas.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm like, oh, I got to see it. There's some crazy awesome archer out there. And I watched the video and I'm like, this guy can't get out of his own way.
Yeah, the thing is, I had the same reaction. Actually, my daughter Julia told me about the video first, because Julia and I are doing archery together, so it's like, oh, Dad, you got to see this guy. My impression was that he is completely spastic. Yeah. He looks so unathletic jumping around. Like, he has no coordination. Like, it's hard to take him seriously. But anyway, the details of what he's explaining, the reason why we don't do archery that way is because it's almost impossible to be accurate when you do what he's doing. So he has managed to figure out how to fire arrows very quickly. You can get off a few shots in rapid succession. But if you notice the demonstration he gives, he's shooting everything very close range. It's all very close range because there's no way he would hit anything 30 feet away doing what he's doing.
But there's another good point to bring up right here. Not only is he's shooting very fast and very close range, but I read about some experts that looked at him draw the bow. He was drawing the bow at maybe 25 or 50% of its capacity, meaning that even if he did hit you at close range, he's not going to pierce. If you had a cardboard vest on it, he wouldn't pierce it because he's not putting the power, because he's sacrificing power for speed. So he would not be effective in a battle at all.
No. I think he's sacrificing power and accuracy for speed.
Yes.
Right. Well, I agree. I mean, he says, oh, look, you could still penetrate like armor, but you're right. There's no way. He's doing. I think some of the demonstrations were also fake. I think a couple of the demonstrations mixed in the video, like he shoots an arrow into a knife and splits the arrow. Mm. First of all, there's no tip on the arrow if you're doing that.
Right.
But there's a couple of times where then he sort of picks up an arrow on the ground that probably was already there. You know what I mean?
Possibly,
look like it's all legit to me.
Well, with video editing, you can't trust any of it.
Yeah.
Right.
But does a trick shot under his legs. Like, was that your 300th attempt at that shot? You have no idea.
Right,
An archery expert said that just watching this guy's technique it's exceptionally poor.
Yeah.
He's not doing the standard, most basic things that you would learn in an archery class, where your anchor point is and everything. Like, the guy was, it's showboating. It's like, it's like a Wild West sharpshooter. It's all just smoke and mirrors.
So you're saying he's no Legolas?
No.
I've met Legolas. I've watched him on the big screen. Lars, you are no Legolas.
But at least by the wig, right? I mean, the guy can always be running around the wig.
And do the ears. You gotta do the ears.
At least.
So one of the takedowns I read about the entire thing was that they got the history completely wrong. So the narration on that video was going through archery history, and they're just making points that were factually wrong, which means that they didn't actually do legitimate research.
No.
And I have an idea. I think the whole thing was deliberate. I think it's very possible that they did this just to see how far it could go. Because when you listen to it, it sounds like, wow, everyone's got it wrong. Nobody knows how to shoot arrows. This guy has been looking at these ancient pictures of people on horseback or whatever shooting arrows, and he has studied these and figured it out. And the takedown I read, it was so awesome because the guy's like, the artists who were painting people shooting bow and arrow were wrong.
Yeah, they were wrong.
And they were copying each other, right? Yeah. So one artist would be like, here's a guy shooting a bow. Then another artist 100 years later would go, oh yeah, I'm going to paint my guy like that.
Yeah, it was a ridiculous assumption to say that the artists were technically accurate. What's funny is we were just in New York over Christmas, and we were at the big tree at the Rockefeller Center. And there was like four, like there was the soldiers playing the instruments.
Yeah, the big statues.
Yeah, right? Every single one was wrong. Right?
They were holding every
instrument incorrectly.
Right.
They were not fingering the flute properly. I think Julia first notes, that guy's holding the flute. She plays the flute. Yeah. Totally wrong. Like the guy's holding the drumsticks wrong. It's like everything was technically inaccurate about though, because it was just art. It wasn't meant to be technically accurate.
Future archaeologists will dig it up and be like, that's how they held it.
That's how they held it. This is what they did with this thing.
But it is funny how viral that went. Who could predict that sort of thing? I bet you it is, though, the Legolas meme that made it go viral, right?
Yeah.
If it weren't for Lord of the Rings, we would not know about New Zealand, and this guy's video would not go viral. You guys watch Flight of the Conchords?
Of course. Yeah.
Occasionally.
Yeah. The posters in the background, like, come to New Zealand. Yeah. It's just like Lord of the Rings. Yeah.
It's just like Lord of the Rings. It got us to go.
And we went to Hobbiton.
We did.
And it was wonderful.
We have photos.
Well, we're going to keep our military theme going. We did archery.
Okay.
Now we're going to do steel. I know you guys are fascinated with steel. Part of this comes out of, my passing fascination with the notion. I had this very specific question, and that is, if you used the absolute best cutting edge of modern 21st century technology, what would you make a sword out of? What would it be made out of? If it was the best sword that modern technology
today,
could make.
You mean the best material that we have, I would imagine it would be some type of steel.
It's still steel, right? It is still some type of steel.
Carbon.
Not like a carbon nanofiber. You'd go with because of tensile strength, or
yeah. So immediately you start to talk about strength and hardness, and there's different kinds of properties of it. So anyway, this I got into this again recently because there was a news item where researchers are still trying to perfect steel. They're still trying to figure out what gives steel its different properties and how to give it better properties. So what the researchers did is they found a way of, they had to find just the right mix of alloys, and then they had to figure out exactly how much to heat it and then how quickly to cool it. Though that's critical. Is heating and cooling is critical.
Like,
to the ultimate properties of
steel. Don't you have to stick it in a slave to cool off?
Slake it in the blood of a slave.
That's what they used to do, right?
It's all about the size of the crystals, right? You want them to be as small as
possible. Yeah. So it's the combination of the various types of crystalline structures that form within the steel, and versus amorphous structure. You always want to get the impurities out, like sulfur. The more you get the impurities out, the better the steel is. There's no positive aspect to having impurities in it. So you could change the properties of steel by adding different alloys. Like, for example, stainless steel has chromium as an alloy. There's a fabulous video on YouTube. It's a guy at a home shopping network showing off a stainless steel samurai sword. And he goes, look how tough this thing is. He hits it against the counter. It breaks off at the hilt and stabs him in the chest. And the guy goes down for the count. And he's like, oh, I'm
that's terrible.
Really
that
bad.
Happened?
That happened. You can
awesome.
Watch it on YouTube.
Did he
All right,
die?
That is fabulous.
No, he didn't die. Didn't stick, it hit him and then it didn't, pierce him. But anyway, what that demonstrates is you would never go into battle with a stainless steel sword because it's brittle. It's stainless. The chromium is good for resisting corrosion. But it's a brittle steel. You would never use it as a weapon, okay. Right? It looks good over the mantle, but that's right. It. For sword steel, the best steel that, again, I'm not an expert here, but I read a lot of people who think that they're experts telling me, like, this is what the best steel would be. You can make what's called spring steel, which would be the opposite of being brittle, right? So this spring steel could bend really far before it would break or before it would permanently bend. So that way you could absorb a lot of energy. Right, that's toughness, right? So you want you want strength and toughness, and it has to be hard at the edge so you can keep an edge, Does that make sense? So like carbon nanofibers wouldn't keep an edge. Maybe you could help the core out with it, but you still need steel around it to hold an edge, for example. Aluminum is a great alloy because it makes it lighter. Titanium is a great alloy. Titanium is probably the best steel that we have today, titanium steel. But there's other alloys, like you would use vanadium, for example. Now, what if you, now there's tool steel. Tool steel, you want it to be hard and heat resistant. So you know what you add if you want it to be heat resistant?
Tungsten?
Tungsten.
Wow, good guess,
but before tungsten, there was what?
Adamantium.
Molybdenum.
Okay.
Oh, of course.
Which, in World War II...
I can't even say that word.
Molybdenum.
Molybdenum.
So molybdenum would work. Also, the steel would tolerate a much higher temperature. Like, for example, if you're repeatedly shooting large shells out of a gun, it melts eventually. But if you just had regular steel, but if you had moly steel, then it could withstand higher temperature. And tungsten steel, even better. Yeah. So guess what the Germans were buying up before World War II?
Tons of tungsten.
They created a company called American Steel. And they were buying up all of our molybdenum.
They were stealing our molybdenum?
They were stealing our steel?
In order to make their weapons, because they knew that they would withstand the higher temperatures of repeated fires.
Now, bastards.
So what happened?
Inglorious bastards.
Inglorious.
So, well, they did it. I mean, they had great weapons in World War II.
But isn't that company still around today?
No.
American Steel? No, you're thinking U.S. Steel.
U.S. Steel.
U.S. Steel.
Yeah. So, but then tungsten replaced molybdenum. Right. Although you still can, you know, you'll still steal with molybdenum. So anyway, what was fascinating to me was that in the 21st century, steel technology is still absolutely critical to our civilization and it's still the cutting edge for a lot of applications. Like this new steel that they made, it's stronger and harder. They basically found a way to combine the right ratio of amorphous and crystalline structure so that you have the best of both worlds. Okay. So you can make a light, hard and strong steel, like for example in making cars. So imagine a car that was 10-20% lighter in the frame, it would be much more fuel efficient.
Yep.
You know, so we're still eking out, you know, more advantages just by figuring out how to heat and alloy steel. It's amazing.
So what do they call it? Does it have a cool name?
I didn't see a name in it.
Oh, come on. Come up with a cool name. You got all right.
It's just high tech steel. So, and you know, iron is, I think the 5% of the Earth's crust is iron. So it's really common element, which is great because there's a ton of it, and it's really useful. Yeah, if you wanted to make yourself a sword and get in a time machine and go back in time and fight in medieval wars, you would still have a steel sword.
Yeah,
it would just be a much better. You'd have a titanium steel, vanadium alloy, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
right.
But the grip could be made out of something.
Okay. Let's do the next news item. I think we might get a lot of people involved with this one. So I'm actually going to ask everyone the question. We have both microphones out there. How many people here think Brian Williams lied?
Liar,
we can't hear you.
Liar, pants on fire.
Evan, what's going on here?
Yeah, Brian Williams. We all know who Brian Williams is, by the way.
Liar.
Okay, so some of you do. For those of us who read and watch news each day, we know him as the NBC anchorman for NBC Nightly News. Everybody else, you probably remember him. He once did a slow jam on Jimmy Fallon's show of the news. So that's probably where you might have known him. So, Brian found himself in a big old boiling pot of water this week. And it all dates back to an incident that took place in 2003. So, March 24th, 2003. Who was around, Ben? Everybody in this room, maybe? That was 2 years before the SGU, and it was 4 years before the first version of the iPhone.
Wow.
Can you believe that? Isn't that remarkable? So in technological terms, it's ancient history. But it's the war in Iraq, okay? We've just gone in. We've waged war. We've led the coalition in there. And we've got boots on the ground and planes in the sky. And Brian Williams is aboard a helicopter. He's embedded with soldiers with the 159th Aviation Regiment for a firsthand account of the Iraq War Theater. And he described it the other night just a week ago, basically, by saying this. These are his words. The story actually started with a terrible moment a dozen years back during the invasion of Iraq when the helicopter we were traveling in was forced down after being hit by an RPG. That's rocket-propelled grenade, by the way. Our traveling NBC News team was rescued, surrounded, and kept alive by an armored, mechanized platoon from the U.S. Army 3rd Infantry. Okay. And Brian had virtually said the same thing a couple years prior in another interview, and that's been his story for the last few years. However, However, Brian Williams' initial reporting of the story, this is back in 2003, and in subsequent years right after 2003, had it a little differently. He said that he was in a different helicopter than one out of another group of helicopters, one of which actually got hit by the RPG, but it was not his helicopter. So recently, one of the flight engineers from the 159th, who was on board one of the helicopters, he heard Williams' most recent accounting of this story, and he went to the media to offer his own recollection of what actually happened, and he set the record straight saying, look, Brian Williams was not, his helicopter was not hit by the RPG. And then other armed forces personnel came along, and of course the media, you know, followed up on this, and they've been kind of getting their hands on as many soldiers who were part of this as they can, trying to really reconstruct sort of what's been going on here. So, just the other night, three nights ago, Brian Williams apologized to his audience on TV. He said he made a mistake in the recalling of the events from 12 years ago and extended his respect and apology to the brave men and women, the air crews who were also in the desert at that time. But it's kind of, in a sense, too late. I mean,
an error in recalling something. What does that mean? An error in recalling something.
The error in recalling.
For a professional newsman.
It's like
a wardrobe malfunction.
Yeah, that's right.
And so,
it's a memory malfunction.
To your point, Joe, like a lot of people, they basically started to light the torches and got out the pitchforks, and they're all calling for Brian Williams, who's supposed to be, you know, this man of great integrity, highly respected newsman, to step down. I mean, really resign his position because he's outright lying. They feel about his retelling of this story. Yeah. Right? He's basically stealing heroism that doesn't belong to him, in a sense. NBC has even launched an internal investigation as to what's going on. So it's not just the public now, you know, corporations are involved and it's become this whole big entire mess. So what's really going on? Did Brian Williams deliberately lie about this and change the history of the story? Or perhaps did Brian Williams kind of have a brain fart?
So I wrote about this during the week, and just to construct an alternate narrative, right? So let's say that he did not deliberately lie. Is it plausible that his memory could have shifted over the years so that 10 years after the fact, he remembers himself being in the helicopter that was hit with enemy fire? Mm-hmm. And the answer is absolutely yes. That is absolutely possible. No question can that happen. This has been demonstrated in multiple psychological studies that, first of all, that we tend to fuse memories, we confuse details. We also tend to personalize memories, meaning we'll take a memory of something that happened to somebody else, and over time we'll remember it as happening to us. And it's actually really easy to get people to do that. You can, in a laboratory setting, you could very easily convince people that they had an experience they didn't have. In fact, just about a year or two ago, there was the Orville Redenbacher study where they did a psychological study where they told people that they were market testing a new popcorn. To one group, they actually gave them a sample of the popcorn to taste and then to describe how yummy it was. And to another group, they had them watch videos of other people tasting the popcorn, and the popcorn was described to them, but they never actually encountered the popcorn. And then a week later, a significant proportion of the people who never ate the popcorn had a memory of them eating the popcorn that they were told about but never actually ate. And anyway, that's just one example.
JFK.
So there's the Hill, you know, testimony, the woman who was the closest to the headshot, you know, of JFK. When she initially was interviewed by TV, she said that she was standing, you know, on the side of the street, but she didn't see anything. Basically said she had no extra details to add to the story. And then over a 40-year period, she was interviewed at regular intervals, you know, pretty much. Her story evolved over time until she maybe saw somebody, then she definitely saw somebody. She saw fire shot from the grassy knoll. And by 30 years later, she was chasing somebody across the street into the grassy knoll. And you can see her story literally evolved. Now, sure, she had a lot of secondary gain. But it's absolutely plausible that her memory evolved in the retelling and retelling and retelling of that story. The other example, which was just a few years ago, 2009, I think, Hillary Clinton made the statement that in Bosnia, she was actually ducking and covering and running from sniper fire. Right. Never happened. There's video of her walking happily across the tarmac, and there was no gunshots. She was not dunking and running. So, in these cases, like with Hillary and with Brian Williams, it certainly seems plausible that their memories shifted over time, that they both would be quite foolish to fabricate a story that could be so easily debunked with video or with other testimony. So like, it's possible they were just stupid, but
So specifically to the point about Brian Williams, Stars and Stripes reported this. As you might imagine, it matters to them. Stars and Stripes reported this, and they had a box, a side box in the online article. And what they did was similar to what Evan just did. They showed different reporting of it, of these same events in the box in different dates, much like we were saying the woman with the 40 years. The first instance of someone conflating Brian Williams with the people in the helicopter wasn't Brian Williams. Somebody else at NBC talked about Brian Williams having been in the helicopter, although the previous report of that by Brian Williams was that it was the helicopter in front of him. It seems plausible that what happened was the story started getting told that way, and it's not like it was told five times a day. It was told once every few months. Someone came out with it. And as you said, it just evolved into this. To his credit, when he was confronted with the change in the story, he immediately came clean on it, but his career may be ruined anyway. Yeah. For a completely human failing.
Some people said, oh, well, he should have checked the record before talking about it. Well, he was talking about it off the cuff. It's not like he was doing a report about it. I mean, how many people, if you have a clear memory of something, I mean, I don't fault a non-psychologist or skeptic or whatever, somebody who isn't familiar with the memory literature, for thinking that because they have a clear memory of something that it's, faulting them for thinking that the memory is accurate. Because that's everybody. Most people think that their memories are accurate, especially if they're clear. But clarity is actually not a predictor of accuracy. So now he knows. What I would love to see is this story turn into a story about how terrible our memories are.
That's the actual critical thinking.
Yes, the unknown novella. Go ahead.
Joe Novella. I would give him a pass because there's poetic license that you have to give people. If I was anywhere near any firing of any weapon in a war, I'd be like, I was in the mix. I was in the shit.
Joe, what you're saying is that there is a slush factor in there if it could help you get laid.
I don't need help, Jay, like you. But if the plane in front of me was being shot at in Iraq, I would take credit for being under fire, honestly.
Well, the thing is, there's a big difference between I don't want to say someone like you to make it sound bad, but there's a difference between
a private citizen versus the head of a major network.
Yeah,
news
one of the big three. Yeah. Big three.
When I read the article, I immediately wanted to be as forgiving as I could, but I'm like, you actually screwed it up in your head whether or not you were in a helicopter that got hit by some type of shrapnel.
Like that's
an RPG license. That is poetic license. He knew the facts. But he was trying to, connect to. He was actually in an audience. Wasn't he in the
Madison
the hockey
Square
game?
Garden? Yes,
yeah. Madison Square Garden, and he was trying to actually speak to how a former soldier had saved his life. So he was trying to create this story of danger and whatnot. Yeah, he put himself in the story.
I don't think there's any doubt that he really thought that was the clear recollection of the events of that day. He didn't go, like Steve said, he didn't go back and fact check it at the time. But the real point of all this is that, look, our brains are not tape recorders, right? We are not video cassette recorders. We fill in missing pieces of the puzzle all the time. Pictures, images, smells, sounds, everything. And our brain kind of has to do its best to take all these memories and try to piece it together as best as it can to make some semblance of a story that we can understand and relate to other people. Yeah. And that's unfortunately, it doesn't always work out.
But Joe, to your point, so I wouldn't give him a pass for consciously altering the details of a story for dramatic effect because he is a journalist. But our brains subconsciously alter the details per dramatic effect. That's exactly what they do. We're more interested. Our brains essentially err on the side of the emotional, thematic impact of the story.
The storytelling part.
The story, yeah. What does the story mean? What's the lesson of the story? And then our brain alters the details, makes up new details in order to make it more emotionally impactful for whatever the lesson and the theme of the story is. If personalizing the story makes it more emotional, like if, you'll go back to our ancestors you know, in Africa where there's a lion in the woods.
We clearly evolved telling stories around a fireplace as opposed to reporting the news.
Well, this yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, if your friend was almost eaten by a tiger, by a lion, and you remember that as almost, you almost being eaten by a lion, you'll be that much more careful next time. What's been disappointing to me is in reading mainstream reports of this, assuming that he's lying. Like, there's no other possible interpretation
of
what happened here. It's really naive as if to think that that's the only explanation. So it's actually a good teaching moment. I don't know how much we're going to get this out there, but it seems to be, yeah, it seems to be overwhelmed by the narrative that the media wants to tell. And their narrative is he was lying.
Right.
Because that gives them the opportunity to moralize and get on their high horse.
And it has to do with soldiers, which is a very sensitive subject on top of everything. And there's very little forgiveness when you start, you know, messing around with what actually happened, what didn't happen in a field of battle.
I think there's very little forgiveness for a news anchor of that magnitude. That's the problem. That's why I immediately got so turned off by the whole thing. Even though I can understand from a skeptical point of view, I feel sorry for him. If he really got caught up in the wash of, you know, just the way our brains work, I feel really bad for him. But at the same time, we have to hold our media up to a higher standard. I don't think it's okay that he screwed it up.
No, I think it's okay he screwed up because otherwise it's an impossible standard. I think his reaction is what's important. And his reaction was, oh, I thought I was going crazy, but I checked and they're right. And this is what happened. And he immediately apologized, corrected the record. What else can you expect? I don't think we can expect people never to have a brain fart, as Evan said. We do this every week. We make a mistake like that. Practically, if you talk for an hour about factual details, you will make those kinds of memory errors and factual errors. I think the standard should be you acknowledge it and you correct it and you move on.
Yeah.
You know, you don't dig in your heels. You don't pretend it didn't happen. Massimo,
I actually tend to agree with this interpretation on this thing. It's the most probable. I mean, nobody really knows, right?
Yeah, nobody knows.
But it's most probable interpretation. And in fact, I've seen happen. It may have happened to me as well. Of course, I don't have a good memory of it. Otherwise, you know. But I've seen happening, for instance, for people that speak a lot, which includes, of course, journalists, you know, media personalities. But you go around and you tell a good story that somebody's told you about it, and then years later you repeat the same story and repeat the same story, and all of a sudden you are the protagonist. You are the one that actually did it. You were at that particular location, and I really don't think that that we should expect that level of perfect memory and perfect behavior from people. What we should expect, as Steve said, is that if something comes up like this, then you're the first one to go back, check, and say, oh, crap, I wasn't mistaken. The only thing I'm not concerned about, and then this came up a few minutes ago, is Brian Williams' career. Regardless of how things are going to go, he's got a perfect spot at Fox News. So it's like, you know, he's going to have a career no matter what. Yeah. NBC or Fox News, he's fine. The thing that really amazes me is how so many in the media are so prompt to moralize in these kind of situations when they in fact give incredible amount of leeway and passing to other situations which are much more grave. Because after all, who is actually being hurt here other than Brian Williams himself? There is lots of other issues in the news every day where the news media don't do their fact-checking job and they don't go after the people, and those actually have consequences. So that's the thing that really upsets me.
Yeah, exactly. Ironically, it is the journalists who are calling Brian Williams a liar who should really be embarrassed. And you know what I mean? Not Brian Williams. He's just a human, and he admitted it, and he moved on, and that's fine.
Hey, look, maybe if they took a more skeptical approach or familiarized themselves a little bit more with kind of the work that, you know, we do and other organizations do in a skeptical approach, maybe they would be able to kind of see this for probably what it was, but it kind of goes to show that they don't, and that's a shame.
It actually points up two problems. One is the 24-hour news cycle. Now you have several stations all dedicated to news 24 hours a day. They have to fill up 24 hours, even when there's nothing interesting to talk about. Back when Steve and I were kids, and you didn't exist yet, Jay, Walter Cronkite was really well trusted. You only saw him on the air for an hour a night, I think. I could be remembering that wrong. You only saw him on the air for an hour a night, and no one knew what his opinions on anything was. Literally, after he retired, we found out that he was pro gun control, and he was like, you know, he had all these things that, like, no one would have trusted the guy at all if they actually knew about him.
And everybody probably thought that he agreed with what they thought.
There were studies, and everybody thought he agreed with them on stuff. And now we have people, they've got to fill airtime. And so we're actually talking about the media, talking about something that happened to someone in the media 12 years ago. That's what this big story all this week is about. It's literally the media talking about a member of the media, something he did and said wrong 12 years ago. Right. And now we're talking about that.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our 500th episode to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Squarespace.
When you're looking to build a website for your company, you know, for personal use, for your blog, if you want to sell things, Squarespace is the best company to use because their back-end software, which is in version 7 now, right, guys, is by far the best that I've ever seen. I've been building websites for 20 years, and you really don't want to become a programmer to build a website. You just want the website to go up and, you know, get on with your business. And this is the company you should be doing it with because their software is the best.
Like you said, Jay, they've got it all. It's simple and it's powerful and it looks great. 24/7 support via live chat and email. And all this for only $8 a month. They're going to also give you a free domain name if you buy Squarespace for the year.
And there's also responsive design so that your website scales to look great on any device that you happen to be using. You can also incorporate commerce. Every website comes with free online store. And there's also cover pages, which is a feature that allows you to set up a beautiful one-page online presence in minutes.
Yeah, so you can start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up with Squarespace, don't forget to use the offer code SGU and you get an extra 10% off your first purchase. All right, guys, let's get back to our show. We're gonna move on to the dumbest thing I heard this week. A new segment we've been trying out. So I thought we would talk about vaginas. Gwyneth Paltrow, you guys are a fan of Gwyneth Paltrow?
Oh my gosh, sure.
On her website,
Goop.
She said Goop, yeah, goop.com. The real golden ticket here is the Mugwort V-Steam. You sit on what is essentially a mini throne, and a combination of infrared and mugwort steam cleanses your uterus at all.
The hell's mugwort steam? What the hell is that?
So what? So she has a device that steam cleans her vagina.
She gives a mugwort herbal steam to energize her vagina.
All right, so I know, now, this is going to sound funny. Like, I know nothing about
vaginas.
Like, from a doctor's perspective. There's no way to say this sentence without setting that bit up. No, but I am not a vagina doctor. I've never played one on TV. I've had some casual experience in my life with vaginas. But one thing I know is it's like you don't wash that out. Douching is bad. Steam douching is probably even worse, right?
You're correct.
Like,
that's correct. You are correct.
Wow, Jay. You know, yes. You know a lot about vaginas.
So we got,
oh my God.
Abraham and Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, nuts, and now vaginas.
And dental and teeth. Vaginas. Teeth, flossing.
I'm very good with dentistry.
So we'll add that to your list of expertise. Anyway, yeah, you're right. I mean, you don't want a hot, steamy vagina. You don't. Sorry.
Speak for yourself.
Because it's naturally lubricated, right?
Yeah.
And if you make it hot and moist with water, all you're doing is creating a perfect environment for fungus. You know, to get
worse.
Yeah, even worse. Yeah, and bacteria, but yeah, you also get a, you know, yeast infection, etc. So you're much better off just having it's self-cleaning and naturally lubricated. That's, you know, you don't need to steam it. Steam is probably the worst thing that you could do. So to any of your mucous membranes, you know, so just they have natural oils in there to keep themselves healthy. You know what I mean? So it's actually not a good idea. But she, you know, obviously is into a lot of magical treatments and stuff. So she thinks that it balances her hormone levels.
What?
Wow.
How does she think that affects her hormones?
Jay, this woman's insane. Have you read the other stuff that this woman?
She is.
I really think she has I think she could be diagnosed.
Well, I would never go there.
Okay, remotely. I'm not going to go. I'm not a doctor, so
it's
I can say that.
It's as if she is insane, but we can't diagnose her.
So
she believes crazy, wacky crap.
Wow. On everything,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah, she
everything,
is.
Well, she hits it all.
Something comes out all the time.
It energizes her vagina.
Yeah.
Energy.
But the fact that she made the statement that it's affecting her hormones, to me, is very troubling. Like, that's scary.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, boy. Okay, she wins.
But she wins. She got it. I mean, I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago, but whatever. She's still
she
in the window.
Any week.
Yeah. But, all right, so sometimes, though, when we do the dumbest thing I heard, there was a very, the best thing we heard in the last week, and we've all been talking about this. So there's another celebrity who actually said something that we all enjoyed. Stephen Fry.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah. Hope you all saw that one. That was a good video.
So, yeah, so he was asked, he was being interviewed for a program. Again, they asked a lot of people this question. He was essentially asked, so you're an atheist, but let's say it's all true. You know, that you die, you are standing at the pearly gates, and God is standing before you, what are you going to say to him? And he gave, I think, you know, nothing, I don't think there's anything new in his answer that hasn't already been passed around in, you know, non-believing circles. This whole notion that not accepting the premise, you know, that we should be kneeling before the Christian idea of what God is. So he completely rejected the premise of the question, but essentially saying, well, if the Christian God were standing before me, I would say, how dare you? You're like a psychopathic maniac.
Right.
You
know? Why kids with bone cancer.
What's that all about? Insects that bore kids' eyes out. If you're omnipotent, why wouldn't you just take care of that?
You could certainly make a universe that doesn't have parasites in it, whose entire life cycle is boring out of the eyes of children and making them blind.
Right.
Yes.
Well, he described God as monstrous, because if God had the... was omnipotent and omniscient, had the ability to at least fix these things or help people that need help. But the fact that if God is the way they describe, logically, God doesn't seem likely to exist, because if an all-loving being had unlimited power and unlimited knowledge, then why the fuck is he letting these things happen?
But most importantly, these are things that we have no control over. They just happen. We're not
doing them to ourselves.
Right. We're not doing it. And that's an important point. But another thing, you said that it's stuff you hadn't heard before, but I hadn't heard before. I loved his angle about that he wouldn't have much problem if these were the Greek gods. He'd be kind of okay with it, because he could, in the sense that he could understand, because they're not pretending to really be anything other than something that is human.
Assholes on the book.
They did not make claims to be omnipotent, omniscient, and I like that angle.
And none of them were all loving. That's a key point here. Like, you can't believe in an all-loving God that can do anything and knows everything and yet lets all these things. But the whole thing is, and that the excuse is that God is mysterious.
God works in mysterious ways, which he may seem like a cruel, monstrous bastard, but we can't understand the mind of God.
We can't see the end game.
Another answer that some people offer is that, well, he's not really omnipotent. You know, like, you can't make a front without a back, you know.
Omnipotent, omniscient, and loving kind. Pick two.
But
you can't have all three in this world. It's not logical.
How do philosophers deal with the omniscient, omnipotent, all-loving God who does horrible things to us?
Pretty much like you do. Most philosophers, except, of course, for those in Notre Dame, in particular, Alvin Plantinga. Of course, that's the major school of, you know, Catholic theology. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the typical canter from theologians and from some philosophers of religion is precisely something along the lines of, well, we don't have access to that information. And, you know, imagine if your dog were trying to figure out why the hell are you here doing what you're doing, right? And it seems actually somewhat plausible, except that it essentially boils down to an argument from ignorance. It essentially says, you know, it's a fancy way to say I have no idea how that could possibly be the case. And that would be more honest to say, you know, the theologian should say, yeah, you got me. I have no idea. And that's where the faith comes in, right? I mean, I actually would have more respect for people who say, look, I have no idea. I'm not trying to come up with reasons. There is no reason that I can come up with. I just have faith. In which case, that's the end of the discussion. One important thing that I think you guys were actually at some point hinting at is the difference between the two types of evil, right? Natural evil and human-made evil. Because the answer, those two issues are different. The theological answer to the human evil, to the existence of human evil, is free will.
Free will.
Right? It's the idea that, well, if God didn't create us capable of doing whatever we want or making whatever choice we want, including the evil ones, then he would essentially have created us without free will. That answer is actually not very convincing. Setting aside the idea that free will in the sense of the theologian is actually a metaphysical oxymoron. It cannot exist. But even setting that aside, it's not very convincing because you can give choices to people. The choices don't have to be all those available. For instance, I can bring my daughter to the ice cream parlor and say, well, you have a choice of chocolate ice cream, you know, vanilla, strawberry, and banana. That's it. You got four choices. She couldn't say, well, I don't have, you're giving me free will because I only have free choices. I don't have infinite choices. No, you have free choices. So the idea that that free will requires absolute choice, including the choice of doing evil, it's actually not particularly easy to defend. What is definitely not easy to defend is the natural evil. Mm-hmm. The cancer, the earthquakes, the tsunamis, all that sort of stuff. That one has got nothing to do with it. The best response, and I use the word best in scare quotes here, that I heard of is from, now the name escapes me, but anyway, he's a modern theologian on the lines of Plantinga, and basically says, look, this is God's way to teach us lessons in character. So overcoming natural disasters, how we react to natural disasters and all that. And my response there is, okay, he could take it down three or four notches.
Yeah.
You know, that's the idea of the God as a father figure, right? And again, so I can use my daughter as an example. It's like, yeah, I want to teach a lesson to my daughter. I'm going to put her in a situation where she's going to survive from the ordeal so that she'll learn something. But if you put her in a situation where she actually dies out of the thing, I don't think she's going to learn that much, frankly.
Massimo, if you cut her leg off, she would get so much out of it. She would just learn so much. What a growing experience.
That would definitely be what a loving father would do, sure. Yeah.
But, you know, I ask myself, why do otherwise intelligent people, why don't they have a problem with this? And there is one answer which I think at least is consistent. It's not an answer that is necessarily likable, but I think it's consistent. If you look at the way evangelical Christians look at biblical inerrancy, and I'll get back to the question of evil in a second, how can the Bible be inerrant when it's so obviously at odds with the world? And the answer is, it's the world that's wrong. We live in a fallen world. We have a fallen world because we ate the apple in the Garden of Eden. And collectively, we are all responsible for the fall of the world. So if there's something wrong with the world, it's our fault. If there's immorality, if there's evil, it all stems from the fall. God is still all loving and benevolent and omniscient and omnipotent, but we've created this fallen world. Now, I said it's consistent. I didn't say it's something that I necessarily agree with, but at least, you know, when you have large groups of people who believe these kinds of things, sometimes it's instructive to go in and try to say, well, why do these people, you know, how can they believe in these logical inconsistencies? And if you look at the world that way, you know, the problem, of course, is that you can then say, well, anything can exist. The world that we see the world as an illusion, and therefore it could be anything. You open the door to almost anything. But at least it seems to me to be a logically consistent way to address evil by saying, we live in a fallen world that's the false world. There is a real world, a perfect world that we're going to get to if we're lucky when we die, but we don't live in that world.
I've actually thought about questions like this a lot this past week, as you guys might imagine. Massimo's point about faith was a good one, but what about speed bumps? They found these microbes. You guys probably even have notes on this. They found these microbes have not evolved in
2 billion years.
2 billion years. Because there was nothing, no reason for them to evolve. They hit their niche. They're fine. They're done. You know, if we change the environment they're in, a lot of them will die. Some will change and they'll evolve. You could make the argument that, first off, a loving God doesn't, you know, if you have 7 children, you don't do something like, okay, well, nothing bad can happen to any of them. Of course, you don't want anything bad to happen to any of them. But if something bad is going to happen, you want to minimize what happens to some compared to all of them. If you got 4 billion, and again, this is not how I actually, but I'm saying this, it's a rational argument. You put speed bumps and we get better. We have medicines now because people got sick and people got tired of seeing people die of being sick. We don't just evolve as a species. We also evolve as a culture and a society because there are things in our path stopping us.
But to Massimo's point, though, you know, to what degree? Like he was saying, a tsunami killed 100,000 people. So speed bumps, like we're fighting against illiteracy and, you know, lack of education, you know, scientific illiteracy. I get that, right? That inspired us to do this program.
Right.
But, you know, at what point, like, where do you draw the line? And my line is, if you're going to say that God is throwing speed bumps in people's way to help them grow, he's doing a really poor job of it.
Is he?
Yeah.
All of human evolution, everything, the entire universe comes down to you now exist. We've gotten to Jay Novella now. You really think we're doing a bad job?
It's a rock in time, Larry.
I'm just saying, you think we're really doing a bad job?
No, you're saying God is the shadows from Babylon 5 is basically what you're saying.
I think he's both. I think in a way he's both.
He's the shadows and
he's in the shadows and the Vorlons. Yeah, I think he's both.
But back to what Massimo was saying, growing up as a Hasidic Jew, one of the most infuriating things about really Orthodox sects of any religion is this excuse that they always have of teaching us a lesson. And it goes back to biblical times, because any page that you open up in the Old Testament, it's filled with such horror that when you ask, what the is going on here? The answer is, oh, God was testing Abraham. He was testing Isaac. He's testing every person. And when I would ask my father, when I became an atheist and asked him questions, the answer and the excuse for everything, always, that we're being tested. We're being tested. The reason there are fossils in the ground, you're being tested about evolution, so on and so forth. Because there are so many crazy things in Judaism. Why for 1/7 of our lives do we not get to turn on a light, not get to cook food, not to get to it? You know what? Because you'll appreciate things more, like he was saying with his daughter. You'll appreciate it more when you do get to drive a car, so on and so forth. Why does a woman not get to touch her husband even after she gives birth to a child and she can't get a hug or anything? Because you know what? Sex is going to be so much more meaningful when you abstain from sex for half of your life. And my response to my father was right away, how come all these abstentions and all these rules are always against women and gay people? How come it's never, you know what? You're really going to enjoy food more if your wife only cooks on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So how about Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays you don't eat? And you'll enjoy it a lot more.
But one more comment about this idea of testing, you know, which comes out often. I mentioned earlier that I do think we need a little bit more sort of philosophical grounding in some, especially these kind of discussions. One of my favorite philosophers, Bertrand Russell, and Bertrand Russell did have an answer to that kind of question. You know, what if you come up to the pearly gates, basically, and say, and God says, well, did I not, you know, show you and give you all the sort of clues possible? And Russell's response was, no, you did not. You gave me a brain that works in a certain way, logical way. I can look at the evidence. I can draw my own conclusions. You gave me that brain. And frankly, all the evidence you gave pointed to the fact that you did not exist. And so you tricked me. So now what? I'm supposed to go to hell because you rigged the game? That's like, it's just not fair. It's like a teacher who wants you to fail and sets up the test in a way that it's simply impossible to pass.
A discussion, right? Of justice, you got me, will come off of that, yeah.
I tell you one last comment, though. Why couldn't a God be, as an agnostic, wannabe atheist, why couldn't God just be a creative God who created the universe and the natural laws are
away?
It? That's it.
Yeah, that's one
notion. Not benevolent.
Just neutral. Started the whole thing and is now
neutral. Pure neutral.
Now out of it. The question is, there's no reason for such a hypothesis, right?
But Joe, my response is, sure, that's possible, right? We can dream it up, and it seems like that makes the most sense. But you can't say, You have a fully engaged God that knows everything, can do everything. That's the problem. We're talking about their version of God, not that God. Yeah. Their version of God.
Right. We can talk
God
about all the different
no
versions
sense.
Of God, and any version of God is just pure speculation.
Yeah, you can make a contrived version of God that is completely unfalsifiable, which is what a lot of people do, and that's fine. But that puts God completely in the realm of faith. Just don't tell me you have evidence that God exists. Because you can't have it both ways. You can't have a God that is completely outside the realm of knowledge, but I know he exists. Well, that doesn't work that way. So we're going to move on to a couple of fun segments. Joshi, you're going to give us another installment of Jewy or Fiction.
Yeah!
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Occasionally, we have guests, either other rogues or guests like Joshi, do the science or fiction. Joshi, you've come up with your own version of science or fiction, which you call Jewy or Fiction. I think this is the fourth time we're doing it?
Fifth.
Fifth time.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's apropos that it's on the Sabbath, so we're all going to hell in a handbasket. Yeah.
Now,
the two awesome things about doing Jew or fiction is that I get lots of people that email from both sides of the spectrum. I get a bunch of people that are Reform or Reconstruction or other type of fake Jews that'll call me and or email me and be like, that's not what real Jews and this and that. And of course, to them and to everyone else, I say, when I say Jew, I grew up as a Hasidic Jew. I refer to Judaism as the extreme version, which we all know that everything only survives based on the extreme version. There'd be no art museums or anything if everyone was just casually into art. You have to really be into something for it to prosper and survive. So I refer to that. But then the most rewarding emails that I get are from people that didn't grow up Jewish at all or grew up Mormon or other things that say to me, that is so cool. We had magic underwear. We had this. And it's so interesting for me now as a skeptic to look back on my life and say, I can't believe the shit that I really believed
that's
in.
That's the problem, is that skeptics don't have magic underwear. That's what we're missing.
Bob. Put that to rest.
You've never seen my underwear.
So, with that being said, first I'd like to give a really nice shout out. Other than SGU, the only other podcast I listen to is someone that is a big fan of SGU, and they raise a lot of money for the SGU Legal Defense Fund, and that's Skeptics with a K, and Mike Marsh. I told him I would give a shout out to them. They're really fucking awesome people. You did incredible. Marsh is awesome. Although it took me a really long time to understand what the hell he's speaking, because unlike me, they don't sound like normal people. And they
right.
Gordon Gorst, I don't know what the hell they're saying. But anyways, so I'm going to give you guys, hello, Massimo.
You.
Daddy's talking. We're going to give you guys four things that Orthodox Jews believe or subscribe to. One of them is made up, and you guys are going to have to guess which one of them is the made up one, which one is fiction, and which of the three are Jewy and in reality something that we still adhere to. Okay. The first one, and I sent you guys this, you guys can look at it briefly. First one is called Cizaligant. Now, everyone knows that kosher food is dependent upon the type of meat that's used, the koshering process, so on and so forth, if there's a rabbi around. But there's one type of food that no matter how kosher it is, if a Gentile, a non-Jew, touches it in an open container, it becomes non-kosher automatically, and that is wine. The reasons being that they used to use wine for idolatry purposes. They used to pour the wine on their idols, whatever. So they always were very cognizant of non-Jews, Gentiles, as we call you guys, touching wine. Therefore, it was customary in all Jewish homes to have one chair in the entire dining room set made a little bit shorter. So if you had a guest that was a Gentile, you'd be able to detect it. If you were coming into a house, you would see the person that's on the shorter chair. You'd know that is not a Jewish person, and you do not hand that person the wine. You simply pour it for him, because once he touches the wine, nobody else at the table can have it. So this is a custom that today still, when Orthodox Jews order furniture in a Jewish furniture store, they get one of the chairs done a little bit shorter, and just to deal with that thing that has now become a tradition. That is number one. Number two is Nida. The laws of Nida, which is for a woman that once she menstruates, she cannot have sex with her husband, is ridiculous and disgusting, and for me to look back upon it is horrifying. But some of the aspects of Nida I think are so hilarious and so disturbing that I think that we have to use it on Jewish fiction. So, the rules of Nida are that after a woman menstruates, she obviously not only can't have sex with her husband, but he can't even touch her like this. Like we've discussed before, she can't hand anything to him. So even if they have a small child, she can't put it into his arms because he may touch her arms. You will see women in Brooklyn, New York, putting down a baby on the ground so that the husband can pick it up just so that he doesn't accidentally touch her pinky or her hand. But what we're doing on Jewish fiction is the fact that rabbis can't really be colorblind, because after a woman finishes menstruating, she has to buy a special cotton cloth that's sold in every Judaic store in Brooklyn or anywhere where there are Jews, and she has to wipe herself and see if there's still menstruation, if there's any color. If it's clear, she then counts 5 days, goes to a ritual bath, and then can have sex with her husband. But What happens if she sees a discharge that's slightly colored? What does she do then? Well, the answer is really simple. There are specialist rabbis that specialize in colors. Perhaps they work for Sherman Williams. And the husband brings the panties to the rabbi and he holds them up to the light and he determines if they are done with the discharge, if this is a regular discharge, if it's still part of the, yeah, Jay, don't make that face. It's sex. It's a beautiful thing. Stop being that type of person. Number two, that's what happens in society. Number three, you see, this is weird. Either one of those first two is fucked up enough to the point that it's weird. Number three, we all know that that food has to be kosher, everything, blah, blah, blah. But clothing also has to be kosher. What you do not know is that if you walk by any tailor or any cleaners or any laundromat in a predominantly Jewish area, there will be a certification on the window that says this establishment has a rabbi that can certify that your clothing are kosher. And the first time you get a suit or anything, you bring it to them, and not just for modesty purposes. We all know that women should not be wearing anything unless it has sleeves and below the ankles. But we're talking about even men's garments have to have a staple in it that has a little thing that says this garment has been certified kosher. That's number three. And the most fun one, number four, is called chalitza. Chalitza is awesome. So the Bible says, and I actually didn't know that this word actually exists, there's a marriage called a levatry or something like that. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. When a guy dies and he has no children, his wife must now, based on biblical commandment, marry one of his unmarried brothers. So let's say you marry someone, you die without children. Your wife now is forced to marry one of your brothers just so that he can continue your family name and bring you children. Let's say you don't want to. Let's say she doesn't cook well, she doesn't like you, this and that. There is another option that the Bible gives, which is still enforced today in all Jewish communities. Again, we're talking about real Jews here. It's enforced in Jewish communities, which is called chalitza, which is, if you and the wife do not want to get married, you will then have a public display where you will meet, she will remove your shoe, put it on the ground, spit on you, and then you shall be, meaning she will be released from the burden of marrying you. One of these things are made up, and horrifyingly, three of these things are really still in effect. So either the short chair, either the woman that's wiping herself and sending the panties to the rabbi, either the clothing that still needs to be kosher, or we have the removing the shoe and spitting on someone so that the brother doesn't have to marry them. Let's start with you, Jay, since you clearly know the least about any of this stuff.
All right, so we have Siz Aligant.
Siz Aligant, yeah.
Siz Aligant.
Try.
Rida. Nida.
That's the second
Nida.
One,
Nida.
Nida
in Star Wars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Shatnez. Is that his
Shatnez.
Like, Shatnez.
Yeah.
Is that the Jewish way of saying
Shatnez? William Shatnez.
No, it's actually an illiteral word that's in the Bible that you can't have Shatnez. You can't, I'm lying, that you can't have clothing that's not kosher.
Okay, and then Chalitza.
Chalitza.
Chalitza. All right.
Yeah.
All right, so these are hard because I can't speak intelligently on any of them. I have no experience
as
with any of this.
To everything else.
The shorter chair one seems ridiculous to me. All right, so that one seems ridiculous, but I guess it serves some type of purpose, which, so I'll put that on my maybe list. The one about the panties, I'm horrified by. I'm just absolutely horrified by it. Like, first off, it sounds like a lot of work. Like, every month, like, the husband has to, carry this moist cloth to a guy that's pretending to know what the
They're
hell he's talking
lives.
About.
I'm not, yeah.
The kosher clothes, to me, that's just money making. And it makes sense in a weird way. Like, yeah, oh, your clothes need to be kosher, and you have to pay me $25 to wave my hand over it. And then the chutzpah one, the shoe and the spit. All right, so this one is the wife doesn't the the widow doesn't want to marry the brother-in-law.
Well, it's actually up to the brother-in-law. We never
it's up to the brother. You're
of
right.
Of course, we don't give the option.
So he's like, no, I don't want to marry her. So then he says, we're not doing this. So you got to take my shoe off and spit in it. And that tells everyone that I break with thee. And then they throw dog poop on their shoes, right? That was Steve Martin. All right. So it's definitely between the kosher clothes and the shoe and spit. And I'm going to say, because I believe money is involved with the kosher clothes, I think the shoe and spit is the fake.
All right. Evan, as the resident Jew, I'll let you go next.
Oh my gosh. Where's Deborah Feldman when I need her? The shorter chair. Okay. There are other crazy things that go around, Jewish tables, having to do with, you know, Seder and stuff, and Elijah coming in, you know, the ghost and so forth. So,
I'm not
all that surprised actually that they've got something for, you know, for the Gentile to come in and somehow be, you know, singled out, so we can look down upon them. That's kind of what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that one's right. The underwear to the rabbi. All right, so this is the one I'm having a problem with. If everything you said is true about that, then why isn't it considered unclean, non-kosher to touch the potentially stained underwear of the woman, you know, and the woman, as opposed to the woman herself? There seems to be a little bit of a disconnect there.
You would have been a rabbi 200-300 years ago.
So I don't know about that one. The kosher clothes, the pinning of the, and the, you know, marking of the clothes and so forth. I kind of think that one's, right. This, shoe and spit thing. Wow. That's incredible. that's an incredible story. And I think that's the other one that's in contention here for being fiction, but it is so ridiculous. So utterly out there that it's gotta be real. And therefore I'm left with the underwear that goes to the rabbi.
So the underwear.
I have to say that one's the fiction.
Alrighty, Bobby.
I actually had the identical thought when the whole panty ritual thing that I listened to, I had heard some of it over the years. I was familiar with some of it. But the wrinkle of having the husband bring the soiled cloth, I was like, well, that's kind of weird. And then I was trying to pay attention to what you were saying, and you clearly said the cloth in the pocket. I'm like, no way. I mean, this person can't sit down where she sat down in case she left some nasty effluvia there, but he's going to take this thing that was a down what you know where in his pocket. No, I don't think so. So for that reason, I'm going to say that little wrinkle to that whole ritual, that little wrinkle you mentioned with the husband bringing it, I think that's going to make it fiction.
Joshy, what if she steamed her vagina?
Oh, Gwyneth Paltrow just threw every rabbi for a loop.
Every rabbi off. Yeah.
Will that make her vagina kosher?
It'll make it glatt kosher, which means super kosher.
Glatt?
Yeah, Hasidic Jews eat only glatt kosher. Steve, lend some skepticism to this thing.
I honestly had the same exact reaction as Evan and Bob to the panties ones. Like, and I definitely was wondering, like, so where's there's a wrinkle there. There's something wrong. I buy every element of the story in that, you know, they have to show that they're over their menses and the rabbi might officiate in some way. I can't wrap my head around the husband carrying the panties in his pocket. You threw it out one little detail with the wine, which made me think that one is real. You said an open container. That was a little detail that gave it the ring of truth. Like, okay, they can touch the wine bottles. They can spy a wine bottle from a Gentile because it's closed. But if it's open, then that makes it no good. So that made it seem real. Anything is kosher, I buy the one. That would make it a really good fiction, but I can't think of any reason to make that implausible. And the shoe and spit, I've never heard of that, but it seems like the kind of thing. I know that a lot of Middle Eastern cultures have to think about shoes, but that's true. Like, they throw shoes at you. That's they're flipping the bird. They're throwing shoes at you. But anyway, I also think that the one that's the most ridiculous, you wouldn't have made up. I think you want the most ridiculous one to be real. So I kind of had the same thought process really as Evan. I'm back to the panties is the one that bothers me the most, so I have to say that one's
fix it. So I'm alone.
Wow, this is a good one. It's a good one, fellas. So we got two panties.
three panties and the shoe.
All right, let's start with the shoe and spit. Doesn't look good for you, right? All right, the shoe and spit is completely real.
Oh, no.
In fact, this is ruled upon by the chief rabbinical court in Israel a year ago, where the with the brother-in-law's family refused to do the chalitza and kept a woman from being allowed to marry her boyfriend for like 13 years because they felt she had married some guy for 3 years, he died, and they said that she had money, she refused to pay for hospital bills, and now under the Jewish law, if you don't do the shuan thing, then she's an adulterer. It's just like yours. She's still married and they didn't do it. So yeah, I'm sorry, Jay. But chalitza is something, look it up. They probably spelled chalitza on Wikipedia. It's something that still goes on today. And let's just move up in order. Let's get to shatness. When we were kids in yeshiva, we had once every month a rabbi come to us and scream at us and yell at us and tell us about how our clothing may not be good because in Deuteronomy and in another place, somewhere in Leviticus in the Bible, it says that thou should not combine linen and wool, and you can't combine those two materials. And there's a lot of speculation as to why. Some of it says because Cain and Abel both wanted to give a gift to God. One wanted to give a plant, and we all know that linen comes from flaxseed. Well, now we all know. And the other one is wool. He wanted to give a sheep. So you're not supposed to combine because Cain killed Abel, blah, blah, blah. There's a bunch of different theories, but you can't wear it. Not only that, even if the inseam, even if the threading for a label for a clothing. So yes, that is true as well. Which leaves us to the panties and the chairs. Let's go to the panties, and I'd love to say that I got you guys good, because the panties is the true one. It is horrible. It is horrible that in today's day and age, there are conversations between what we used to call, you know, open-minded religious Jews, which I thought I was, saying, all right, which rabbi should I take my panties to because they look a little on the dark side? Which is the rabbi that's the most lenient on color? The bottom line is you have to take your panties when you're unsure, and then she has to count 5 days from when the rabbi says she is good and clear. Which leads me to the chair, which was just made up, but I think is an awesome idea. And I think that if there are any religious people listening now, I know that this one guy that owns a furniture store, yeah, that's sitting there with a saw in his head right now. Hey, the wine, look at Talmud, you know, whatever the section is.
Awesome. You have this huge scam where you sneak back into the Jewish community and you try to get that thing to happen.
I have a yarmulke upstairs in my that coat. Awesome. That, so thank you guys for another edition of Jewia Fiction.
The chair.
All right. Thanks, Joshy.
Hey.
Wait, I don't get to vote in on the real science fiction.
You guys, sit down.
Yeah.
You want to do another one?
We're going to do a very quick regular science fiction, but this is a theme. There's a theme to this
secular science or fiction.
The theme is 500!
I love 500! It's my favorite number today.
Yeah, is it?
It
all right, these three items all have to do with the number 500.
All right, go ahead.
All right, ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Item number one. In the year 500 BCE, the estimated total human population was 100 million. Right, 100 million in 500 BCE. Number two, in the 20th century, there were four 500-year floods of the Mississippi River. And item number three, the Western Electric Model 500 telephone was the standard Bell System phone in North America from 1950 through 1984 and is the most common telephone ever produced. Let's start with Joshy.
I don't remember all of them, but I'm going to say the first one is false because it just sounds like a lot of people. And one of the awesome statistics that I remembered that I've heard was from the Jared Diamond that says that 10,000 years ago, 98% of all the weight, if you combined all the animals, the mammals, he says, on Earth, were comprised of non-humans, like cattle and so on. And today, in the year 2015, I think 99% of all the weight on Earth is humans. And that's how many humans we have now and how few cattle we have now. So I think that's just way too many humans to have in the year 500 BC when the Jews received the Torah from Har Sinai or something like that. Bob?
100 million in 500 BCE? 500. Yeah, that does sound a little high. But four 500-year floods in the 20th century. Wow. I have seen those types of disasters that are like, you know, once in a century, happening frequently.
Every 10 years. Yeah.
I could see, I've seen that happen. So I guess in the Western Electric one, 50 to 84, most common, that one model that did not change. All right, I'm trying to remember back so long ago. Not to the 50s, obviously, but 70s and 80s. Yeah, I mean, I could see that one style. It really, there wasn't much innovation. And I would think 84 is like around the time where it really started going crazy. So I'm going to go with the 100 million population of 500. It just sounds a little bit too high.
Booyah!
I'm oddly going to go with the first one, the 100 million population, but I'm going in the opposite direction. I think that number is too low.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. What?
Okay.
Yeah. I thought the number was too low as well, Jay.
Well, why don't we do it together, Ev?
Well, let's gang up.
Yeah, I think we will do it together. I was going to say the Mississippi River one, 20th century, but yeah, that definitely could have happened, I think. Yeah, I'll go with the 100 million.
Yeah, GWJ.
We're all on the arc together.
Go with Joshy.
GWJ.
You guys are unanimous. So let's do reverse order, like Joshy. We'll start with number three. The Western Electric Model 500 telephone.
That's science.
Was the standard Bell System phone in North America from 1950 to 1984 and is the most common telephone ever produced. That is science.
Yeah!
That's the iconic phone.
Yeah. Phone, yes.
That's the phone with the dial. The slanted
with the metal
dial.
Plate on the bottom.
Yeah, you can hang up, you know.
I miss that.
Yeah.
I don't miss it at all.
My thought about that was perhaps...
What? A rotary dial.
You know what? Who doesn't know?
It has a bell. That would bell. It would ring.
84.
Yes, the circle. The dial would turn.
When you hated people that had the number 9 because you had to go all the way around. You loved people that had 232 numbers.
Oh, yeah, the low numbers?
That's the most iconic phone ever. Right,
which raises a Monty Hall problem now. We all wish to change to number 2.
In the 20th century... There were 4 500-year floods of the Mississippi River. You all think this one is science.
Sure, why not?
Yes, we do.
And this one is the fiction.
Oh!
We cut all of us. Jesus. Nasty. That was not...
Sorry,
that's
Bob.
Nasty, baby.
There goes my streak. I'm out of here.
Yeah, there weren't 4 500-year floods. The way that a 100-year flood and a 500-year flood... a 100-year flood is a flood where there's a 1% chance... in any given year of there being a worse flood. A 500-year flood means there's a 0.2% chance in any given year of there being a worse flood. So if there were like one or two in the 20th century, not four. 1993 was the last one in the 20th century, the last 500-year flood. Then there was, I think, one 1927. Then there were a couple of 100-year floods, maybe one. The 2011, there was a big flood. Do you remember that? But there weren't 4 500-year floods. Okay. So that I made that one up. Okay, and that means in the year 500 BCE, the estimated total human population was 100 million. That one is science. Nice. That's the estimated population.
Census takers.
Some thought it was too high, too low, but 100 million.
That's what the scientists say.
That's the scientists say. All right. So, Evan.
Yes.
This was a fun episode. This was different.
This was a dynamite episode.
Yeah, it was great.
Billy,
was
great. You guys made it all very special.
You're going to close this out with a quote.
This episode sucked.
I am going to do that. And I'm going to reach back into our history. We're celebrating 500 today. A lot has happened in the nine plus years that we've gotten to this point of 500. Do you guys recall from our first version of our website, we had a quote up there.
Yeah.
That was a Carl Sagan quote. So I'd like to rekindle that one and then give you a little did you know about Carl Sagan as well. For me, it is far better to grasp the universe as it really is than to persist in delusion, however satisfying and reassuring. And that was written by Carl Sagan from his book, The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. And that used to be on our website, on our banner. And did you know, speaking of Carl Sagan, in 1994, Apple chose the internal code name Carl Sagan for its Power Mac 7100. Though it was meant to be an homage to Carl and an inside joke that the computer would make Apple billions and billions of dollars. They also used the code names Piltdown Man and Cold Fusion for the Power Mac 6100 and 8100 respectively. When Carl found out that he was being put alongside scientific hoaxes, he sued Apple. Yes, he did. And though Apple won the suit, the code name was changed to BHA, which Apple jokingly referred to as Butthead Astronomer. Carl did not think that was funny.
it prompted yet another lawsuit. But Apple won again, so that's two down for Carl. Apple won twice. But, as part of the settlement, the lawyers agreed the engineers would change the code name one more time, and they did. The PowerMac 7100 was known by its final code name, LAW, Law, which stood for Lawyers Are Wimps. Well, there you have it.
All right, well, thank you all for joining me this week. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.